The Ethical State. An Essay on Political Ethics. By John David Garcia. Chapter 1, The Essential Background. Ethics, Government, Religion, and Quantum Evolution. Introduction. This book is written primarily for those who have read and understood my previous book, Creative Transformation, 115. Each book I have written has had errors and shortcomings. However, I have tried to correct the shortcomings of each book in my succeeding books. At first I thought that my first book, The Moral Society, 116, was too complex and abstract for most people. Not only was it not understood, but it was grossly misunderstood, even by people who seemed to appreciate it, and people would project their own fears and prejudices into my writing, although I had taken great pains to make everything clear and simple enough for an intelligent high school graduate to understand. Therefore, I wrote a second book, Psychofraud and Ethical Therapy, 117, which was much simpler and more focused, in the hope that it would lead others to read and properly understand The Moral Society, 116. This did not happen, and I spent the next 15 years trying to help others understand my first book, while simultaneously trying to understand why so many ethical, intelligent, well-educated people could not understand what to me seemed like a relatively simple, very clear book. Finally, after 20 years of effort, I thought I had the solution to the problem. In 1991 I published my new book, Creative Transformation, 115, hoping that I had now corrected the errors in both of my previous books. This book was much clearer than my previous two books, and it did not lend itself to misunderstanding, but, still, very few people understood it. I now know that my problem was not due to a lack of education or intelligence on the part of my readers, but due to the fact that what I was most trying to communicate was, to many, a new system of ethics. It seems that most people cannot understand a rational system of ethics unless they fully share its values, no matter how intelligent or well-educated they are. The ethical values that I was trying to communicate are the natural universal values with which we are all born. They were the ethics taught by Moses, Jesus, and Spinoza. But as Nietzsche said, there has been but one Christian, and he died on the cross. I would correct Nietzsche and say, there has been at least one other Christian. He was a Spanish Jew accused of atheism, despised by the Jews and Christians of his time, and deprecated, but ever less so, by academics up to the present. His name was Baruch de Spinoza. Spinoza is a very difficult philosopher to understand. I did not begin to understand him until I had independently derived his ethical system using my own reasoning, together with over 300 years of scientific knowledge not available to Spinoza. All my work is at best an aid in understanding how to practically apply the ethics of Spinoza, whom I regard as probably the greatest thinker who ever lived. The best I can do to help you understand Spinoza is to tell you how I came to understand him, and guide you down the same road that I took, without your having to repeat all of my many mistakes made along the way. Many great minds have read and appreciated Spinoza, but few have understood him well. Among the greatest minds who have commented on Spinoza is Leibniz, who appreciated him intellectually, without sharing his ethics, and as a consequence did not understand him well and, in fact, attacked him publicly, while privately incorporating Spinoza's ideas into his own philosophy, 358. This line of misunderstanding led to a series of further misunderstandings of Spinoza's philosophy that through Kant, Hegel, Marx, Engels, and others eventually led to Lenin and the Soviet Union, possibly one of the most evil systems of government in the history of world. The second line of misunderstanding of Spinoza by great minds went from Locke, Hume, Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, and others to Thomas Jefferson, and the United States Declaration of Independence and Constitution, which represents among the best systems of government in the history of the world, at least in theory. However, this system, it is now obvious, is filled with errors and inadequacies and is breaking down. The governmental ethic of Jefferson, as well as some of the other founding fathers, that freedom is the greatest good and tyranny is the greatest evil is ethically only partially true. Freedom is necessary, but not sufficient, for ethical government. In the United States, and almost all other countries, the concept of democracy has been corrupted to mean majority rule. Democracy means the rule of the people, not majority rule. The notion of democracy to mean self-government, as well as the democratic ethic, are ethical but incomplete. By democracy I mean solely self-government without any form of tyranny, without anarchy, and without bureaucracy. This will be seen to be a radical new concept of government never before tried on a national level, although it has been used effectively within small groups. Theoretically, this concept of self-government is the concept of government originally entertained by the founding fathers of the United States, and still advocated by the Libertarian Party in the United States. However, it has never been made functionally practical. It is my intention to do so. Every form of tyranny is unethical. Majority rule is inherently unethical, because it is, at best, a tyranny of the majority over minorities, at worst it is a tyranny of a plutocratic few over an ignorant majority which is manipulated to exploit the most creative minorities that a nation can produce. The manipulation is done by telling the ignorant majority the comforting lies that they wish to hear, and by confiscating the fruits of the labor of the most creative minorities and then redistributing them among the majority, with large commissions to the plutocratic minority, and the bureaucrats and politicians who support this system. The third line of great minds who misunderstood Spinoza stemmed from Moses Mendelssohn, the grandfather of the composer. This line led to what today is known as conservative, reform, and secular Judaism. This line preserved Jewish ethics within a modern social context, but it could not preserve Judaism itself, or its ethics, for long, since the descendants of these Jews were quickly assimilated into modern society, and within a few generations lost their Jewish ethics along with their Jewish identity. It was thus a political failure, although it was an intellectual success. The ethics of Spinoza and Reform Judaism are preserved within a non-Jewish context by religions such as the Unitarians, the Universalists, and the more secular ethical culture society, but they seem to be having ever less impact on modern life, as more and more people become ethical hedonists and/or followers of the consumerist ethic, wherein the more material wealth is the greatest good, and poverty is the greatest evil. Spinoza's ethics are theoretically correct, but have not been very effective. I hope to make the ethics of Spinoza practical and effective. The two greatest modern appreciators and interpreters of Spinoza are Bertrand Russell and Constantin Brunner. Both of these great minds were influenced by two other great appreciators of Spinoza, Einstein and Goethe. Brunner more by Goethe, and Russell more by Einstein. Few people, who do not read German, know about Brunner, but almost all educated people know about Russell. He was the first great thinker who had a significant impact on my life. As a young man I was trained as a scientist, with good undergraduate and graduate backgrounds in biology, chemistry, psychology, physics, and mathematics. I had tried to understand Spinoza, but I simply could not, I was neither sufficiently intelligent nor ethical. However, the two men whom I most admired at that time also greatly admired Spinoza. They were Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell. Therefore, I read everything I could by both Einstein and Russell, and used them both as my role models. The best summary I have ever read of Spinoza and his philosophy is in Russell's History of Western Philosophy, 358. I recommend that everyone who wishes to understand Spinoza begin with this summary. However, the entire history should be read in detail, cover to cover. It was this summary which kept me coming back to Spinoza, and forcing me to try to better understand him. I am still doing that today. I read Constantin Brunner late in life, and know him primarily, and indirectly, through my late good friend, Henri Lurie, 225. Henri was one of the most brilliant, ethical persons I ever met, and he was a devoted follower of Brunner. Shortly before he died, Henri gave me a complete set of his translations, commentaries, and presentations of the works of Brunner and Spinoza. I have put my Spanish version of Henri's presentation of Spinoza's ethics online, and I hope to eventually put all of Henri's writings online at www.sce.org. The main value that I got out of Brunner was to understand, for the first time in my life, that the ethics and teachings of Moses, Jesus, and Spinoza were one and the same. Furthermore, I realized that the most beautiful and greatest expressions of the teachings of Moses, at the mystical level, were those of Jesus, and the most beautiful and greatest expressions of the teachings of Moses, at the intellectual level, were those of Spinoza, although I also regard Spinoza as a mystic, and Jesus as an intellectual, 38-41. It is not possible to understand the teachings of Moses well unless one knows Hebrew and Aramaic well enough to read and understand the Old Testament, Torah, and the Talmud in their original languages, as did Jesus and Spinoza. It is not possible to understand the teachings of Jesus well unless one knows Greek well enough to read and understand the New Testament and Socrates, Plato in the Greek in which they were originally written. If they were first written in Aramaic, the language of Jesus, then no copy of the original Gospels is known to survive. It is not possible to understand the teachings of Jesus well, unless one understands Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, Latin, and Germanic languages well enough, as did Spinoza, to understand modern science and the teachings of Maimonides. It is not possible to understand Spinoza well unless one knows the essential languages known to Spinoza, as well as English, in order to understand the most modern science. I have known solely one man in my life who had this understanding of language, the most modern science and technology, and the teachings of Moses, Jesus, and Spinoza. His name was Henri Lurie. He was a devoted follower of the teachings of Constantin Brunner. He was the best friend I ever had, but I did not realize it until after he died at the age of 95 in 1994. The great thinker who had, in fact, the greatest impact of all on my life was Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. I first read his book, The Phenomenon of Man, 438, in English translation, although I read French well, at the age of 34, it changed my life forever. However, I recommend that all who can, try to read Teilhard in the original French, 431-439. His language is gorgeous. After reading Teilhard, I began to develop a better understanding of Russell, Spinoza, and myself. I was at the time a very successful high-technology entrepreneur. Afterward, I became more and more concerned with ethical values, and ever less concerned with material success. Within 1 year I had changed into a man indifferent to material wealth, and obsessed with communicating the combined ideas of Spinoza, Teilhard, and myself to others. This obsession verged on a form of temporary insanity. The first thing I did was begin to write my first book, The Moral Society, 116. This led me to understand well, for the first time in my life, the philosophy of Spinoza. However, my first book was much less popular than Teilhard's, and less intellectually complete than Spinoza's. This led me to a series of experiments, and further books, including that which I write now. I am now not so obsessed, and I hope I have fully regained my sanity. My goal is to help you, and myself, understand well the ethics of Spinoza, as well as to implement them practically in a viable, ethical government. The best way for you to begin is to give a quick reading to what you can understand of Spinoza's major works without trying to follow his proofs. Then do your best to acquire the best broad background you can in mathematics and science, 1-600, while reading all you can of Bertrand Russell's many excellent books, 346-358, but focusing on his History of Western Philosophy, 358, and particularly focusing on his summary of Spinoza's philosophy. The next step is to read as much as you can of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, 431-439, focusing on finishing and understanding the phenomenon of man, 438. Then see how the philosophies of Spinoza and Teilhard fit together. Few people can see the connection between the two. My own books will help you in accomplishing this task. I now realize that the major value of my life is bringing together these two apparently disparate systems of values and philosophy. To the best of my knowledge, no one else has done this. The followers of Constantin Brunner, whom I know personally, including my late friend Henri Lurie, had, at best, mild contempt for Teilhard and little sympathy for the evolutionary perspective. I nonetheless respect Brunner's followers, and I greatly loved Henri. But my ideas are different. What we all have in common is a great love and respect for the teachings of Moses, Jesus, and Spinoza. With Teilhard I share the love and understanding of Jesus, Darwin, and the evolutionary process itself, which I, and others, call God. This is the God of Spinoza and Einstein. It is also the God of Moses and Jesus. This God is truly our Father. Once you have read the aforementioned books, the goal is then to understand my last book, Creative Transformation, 115, give this book a quick reading. If you understand it well, then read it again, and read my other books solely to see how my ideas developed. If you do not understand it well, then read first my other books in any order you wish, then make sure you read some of the books by David Bohm, 31-35. Some of Bohm's books require a graduate level knowledge of physics to understand, but some, such as Science, Order, and Creativity, 33, are relatively easy, and philosophically sufficient, requiring no mathematical sophistication. Next to Russell, Teilhard, and Spinoza, the thinker who had the greatest impact on my understanding of Spinoza was David Bohm. Although I do not know of Bohm ever mentioning Spinoza, I believe he must have read him. Bohm, like Einstein before him, has Spinoza's spirit and ideas throughout all his writings, most of which I read after writing my last book. In my last book I integrated the philosophy of Spinoza, Teilhard, and myself through an early, imperfect understanding of Bohm's model of nature and quantum mechanics. I understand this much better now. Bohm's model implies that the underlying ultimate reality in nature is not energy or matter, but information. And furthermore that there is a universe of infinite true information at our fingertips, which is the ultimate, unifying cause behind all physical, biological, mental, and spiritual phenomena. This model enables us to unify true science with true mysticism. There can never be a conflict between true science and true mysticism, when there is, either the science, the mysticism, or both are wrong. I recommend that you begin a study of Bohm by first reading his Science, Order, and Creativity, 33, which he co-authored with F. David Peet. If you cannot understand it, I recommend that you go back and study more physics. The book is written for a general audience. If you already know physics well, I recommend that you then try Bohm's last and best book, The Undivided Universe, which he co-authored with Basil Hilly in 1993. It was published shortly after Bohm's death. This book is written for professional physicists. Bohm has written many excellent books for professional physicists, as well as for the general public, 31-35. Bohm is somewhat difficult to read and understand, but he is much easier to understand than Spinoza, although not easier to read. Although Bohm was a great physicist, he was, unlike Spinoza, not a great writer. Bohm is easiest to read and understand when he writes in collaboration with an excellent writer of English, such as F. David Peet or Basil Hilly. The last, and perhaps least essential books you should read are those of Constantin Brunner, 38-41, which make a creative and very original synthesis of the teachings of Moses, Jesus, and Spinoza. These books have considerable value, but Brunner was somewhat academically oriented, and he was also somewhat anti-scientific, highly polemical, and much less than rigorous in his thinking, which is primarily polemical and aesthetic in orientation, as is much of German philosophy. Furthermore, he wrote all his books in German, and they are not readily available in translation. I will eventually have many of his books, in English and French, online at SCE.org. He had an impact on my life and led me to a much better appreciation and understanding of Moses, Jesus, and Spinoza. This understanding was particularly enhanced by my personal friendship with Henri Lurie. I have put Henri's translation of Spinoza's Ethics, directly from the original Latin, on my website, www.sce.org, in a Spanish version which I produced. Henri was a great linguist. He was a master of Latin and Greek, and elegantly fluent in French and German, but English was a language he acquired late in life, and he did not write it very well. My Spanish presentation is superior to his English presentation, but probably not as good as his German and French presentations of Spinoza. I hope eventually to have all of Henry's translations of Brunner and Spinoza in French, German, and English on www.sce.org, together with the Spanish version of the Ethics already there. There is some irony in this, because Spinoza's native language was Spanish, a language he spoke fluently, but in which he apparently never wrote any of his known works. Spinoza wrote mostly in Latin, which is very close to Spanish, and less in Dutch, which is further from Spanish. He also wrote in Hebrew, which is much further from Spanish than Dutch, but not unrelated to Spanish. The 800 years during which the Jews and Arabs flourished in Spain had a great impact on the Spanish language. Spanish is my native language, and I speak it fluently, but I write best in English, as those of you who read both will discover. I now realize that the Ethics represents the work of a great mind that could think and write equally well in Spanish, Hebrew, Aramaic, Latin, and Dutch. Read my online play, Baruch, The Trial of Spinoza, which was deeply edited by my friend, Roberta Myers, and you will understand why. The opening of myself to true mysticism, through an appreciation of modern quantum mechanics, came from an interaction I had with Amit Goswami, a professor of physics at the University of Oregon. Although I know physics well, my understanding is less than that of professional physicists such as Amit Goswami and David Bohm, and much, much less than David Bohm. Both Amit and Bohm are totally mystical in their science, and totally scientific in their mysticism. Amit is a thoroughgoing mystic, born in India. Bohm was a student and collaborator of the Indian mystic Krishnamurti. Amit Goswami is also my friend. He wrote his ideas in an excellent book, The Self-Aware Universe, 123. Although there is some conflict between Amit's and Bohm's models of quantum mechanics, as well as with my synthesis of the two, the three models all have much in common. Someday there may be a single, information-based model of quantum mechanics which resolves all the differences between them and unites their large areas of commonality. I recommend reading Amit's books, 121 to 123. In this book I unify all the important concepts and ideas from my previous books, 115 to 117, that still seem correct and summarize them in this first chapter together with all the new ideas and concepts that I have developed since 1990 when I finished writing my last book. My basic conclusions follow. The sole true ethic in the universe which does not lead to its own contradiction when it is applied to government is the evolutionary ethic, which is summarized in the following statements. 1. We must do our best to maximize the creativity of every person in the universe, including our own, without ever decreasing the creativity of any person, including our own. 2. We fulfill our moral obligation to maximize creativity by giving first priority to our children, then to our spouse, then to ourselves, then to our friends in proportion to the friendship between us, then to our neighbors, then to our fellow citizens, then to our fellow humans, then to other species in proportion to the ethical development of the species. 3. Creativity is the process of increasing ethical truth for at least one person without decreasing ethical truth for any person. 4. Ethical truth is information which increases the intelligence or ethics of at least one person without decreasing the intelligence or ethics of any person. 5. A person is ethical if, and only if, he or she values truth more than happiness. 6. Information is true if, and only if, believing this information enhances our ability to predict and control some aspect of the total environment, physical, biological, and/or psychosocial, without decreasing this ability in any other aspect of the total environment for anybody. 7. The first obligation of any ethical government is never to decrease ethical truth for anyone. 8. Any government that decreases ethical truth for even a single person has behaved unethically, no matter how many other people are allegedly to be benefited by this sacrifice. Unethical means can never achieve ethical ends. The ends never justify the means. It is unethical to ever harm a single person. Harm is any decrease in ethical truth or creativity for any person. 9. A government can be ethical if, and only if, it limits its activities to protecting well the life, liberty, property, and privacy of its citizens without ever imposing undeserved harm on anyone, or ever trying to do good for anyone. 10. No government can do good, outside of protecting basic civil rights, for anyone without in the process imposing undeserved harm on someone. 11. Harm is the decrease in ethical truth for anyone. Undeserved harm is imposing unnecessary harm on anyone against the will of the person harmed. Solely the minimum harm necessary to defend our life, liberty, property, and privacy against an aggressor can ever be ethically justified. This is a deserved harm. 12. No government can be ethical if it is in any way subject to majority rule, anarchistic, bureaucratic, tyrannical, or inadequate in protecting the life, liberty, property, and privacy of all its citizens and their dependents. 13. The right to the basic human rights of life, liberty, property, and privacy cannot be maintained without an absolute right to private property. 309. 14. A person's life and property belong solely to that person. No person has a right to any part of another person's life or property, except, possibly, by prior mutual, voluntary contract, which is kept by at least one of the parties to the contract. When someone violates his or her contract with us, that allows us, at our discretion, to abrogate our obligations to that person, under this same contract. This is true no matter how great the need of anyone for the life or property of another. 15. Every form of socialism is unethical, unless it is totally voluntary by unanimous consensus between all the persons involved in producing wealth, redistributing it, and receiving it. Charity must be entirely voluntary and not imposed by government, otherwise charity becomes evil and destructive. 16. In order for any system of government to be ethical and effective, the unit of autonomy and sovereignty cannot be larger than 5 men and 5 women, nor much smaller than 4 men and 4 women, which is optimal. 17. There should never be more men than women in the unit of sovereignty, called an octet, if it is to be effective and remain ethical. 18. The optimal size for a unit of sovereignty is 4 men and 4 women, not the nation-state, however small. If any organization has any unethical persons in its membership, and this membership is greater than 10 persons, it shall become increasingly bureaucratic and unethical until it reaches the potential to become totally unethical and completely destructive, at a membership of 16 or more persons. 19. Men and women are neurologically, as well as sexually, complementary to one another. All decisions of government at all levels, including the family, are better made by consensus between at least one man and at least one woman, who share a common set of true ethical values, and voluntarily choose to work together. 115-117, 527-600, this unit is called a complementary pair. Complementary pairs need not be married to one another, and, in fact, may be married to, and have families with, persons who are not within a complementary pair with them, although a good marriage will always be between persons who are a complementary pair. 20. The most creative interactions between complementary pairs are achieved within octets, which work by consensus among the up to 5 complementary pairs that compose the octet. 21. There exists a technology of creative synergy between complementary pairs and within octets, called autopoiesis, which facilitates consensus and amplifies individual and collective creativity. This is described in detail within my book, Creative Transformation, 115. This is a generalization of a much more specific biological term coined by Varela and Maturana, 462. It would be better to call this process of creative information exchange between complementary pairs of entities simply creative synergy. Otherwise it produces confusions with persons who have used the term its original sense. Autopoiesis, in its more specific, biological sense, basically means creative synergy between DNA and protein within a living cell. I believe that my definition of autopoiesis includes the concept originally conceived by Varela and Maturana. I was trying to honor them, and instead I produced confusion. This confusion will not occur in persons who even partially share the evolutionary ethic. It is too late to change my use of autopoiesis, which I have now communicated to many thousands of people. I apologize to Varela and Maturana for usurping their word, and to all people who have been confused by this. 22. The closest approximation to ethical government is given in the draft of the Declaration of Independence as originally written by Thomas Jefferson, 229. This version of the Declaration was never adopted. Almost every other aspect of American government has diminished the ethical principles of the original Declaration of Independence. Except for the Bill of Rights, as well as the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, the checks and balances system, and other features which protect basic human rights and somewhat limit government corruption. 23. How to understand and apply practically the fundamental ethics of the teachings of Moses, Jesus, Spinoza, Teilhard, and Jefferson is part of the goal of this book. 24. A reading of Thomas Jefferson's writing on ethics and government, particularly the original Declaration of Independence, and his book known as the Jefferson Bible, The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, 176, is good way of beginning to see how Judaism, Christianity, Spinoza's ethics, and the ethical foundation of American government are all interrelated. 25. Whoever does not share and understand Judeo-Christian ethics and the ethical foundations of American government will neither share nor understand the ethics and governmental concepts to be developed in this book. Such a person is neither a good Jew, Christian, nor American. 26. No one can intellectually understand an ethical system that he or she does not intuitively share at the unconscious or mystical level. 27. The understanding of ethics inherent in Judeo-Christian ethics is more mystical than intellectual. 26. The greatest mystical understanding of ethics is the understanding of Jesus. 29. The greatest intellectual understanding of ethics is the understanding of Spinoza. 30. This book is an attempt to combine the mystical understanding of Jesus with the intellectual understanding of Spinoza, and to make it all practical and understandable to an intelligent high school graduate. 31. No one who does not already share the evolutionary ethic with me will ever understand this book or any of my other books at any level, no matter how intelligent and well-educated they are. 32. Every healthy human being is born ethical with the potential to fully understand the evolutionary ethic. 33. Human beings lose their innate ethics and capacity to understand the evolutionary ethic only because they are punished when they behave ethically and/or rewarded when they behave unethically. 34. Every institution of government and society in every nation in the history of the world eventually punishes ethical behavior and rewards unethical behavior. This happens in the home, the school, the economy, and the government. It is the sole, legitimate function of ethical government to prevent this harm when it is undeserved. Otherwise, unethical people should be allowed to harm themselves. They deserve it. Ethics and history. Ethics is defined by the dictionary as the study of what is good or as a set of normative principles. The philosopher Wittgenstein showed, quite convincingly, that there cannot be a scientific ethics, because we can never infer aught from is. 193, 496 to 499. I believe that Wittgenstein was wrong. It is a well-known theorem in mathematics that one can never optimize a function on more than one variable at a time, although other variables may be constrained. If there were an infinity of normative criteria, as most academic philosophers believe today, then Wittgenstein would be correct, and there could be no absolute criteria of good and evil. However, I believe that there is a single normative principle in the universe that can lead to a logically consistent system of ethics, 115 to 117. Furthermore, the use of any other normative principle will lead to a logically and scientifically inconsistent system of ethics. This normative principle is implicit in Judeo-Christian ethics as expressed in the Bible and the teachings of Jesus, and was first made explicit by Baruch de Spinoza, 410 to 412. It is possible, through the use of modern quantum mechanics, to integrate and scientifically explain the notions of scientific ethics, creativity, true mysticism, and traditional religious ethics, particularly Judeo-Christian ethics, 115. At the core of any civilization is a system of values or ethics together with assumptions about reality. The European civilization, out of which America emerged as a new civilization, had at its core, as was long held by the Christian churches, the natural, hierarchical order of things, Christian ethics, and a notion of the hereditary superiority of some people over other people, solely the Christian ethics, which stem entirely from Jewish ethics, seem valid. This system was highly compatible with the hierarchical order of the Catholic Church, extending beyond this world all the way to God, but less so with the new Protestant sects, which claimed, and occasionally tolerated, respect for individual conscience, so long as this conscience was compatible with the prevalent interpretations of the locally accepted Protestant Bible. The scientific revolution, which began at about the same time as the Reformation, and had common causes behind it, showed any rational person that almost all the Christian religious authorities were wrong about nearly everything in the natural world from astronomy to zoology. It was reasonable to assume that the same religious authority was probably also wrong about the psychosocial and ethical world as well. Therefore, rational people began to look to reason and science to guide them in moral philosophy, ethical behavior and psychosocial sciences, as well as in natural philosophy, physical and biological sciences. The pioneers in this approach were humanists, such as Francis Bacon and Thomas Hobbes in England, and Michel de Montaigne and René Descartes in France, 358. The culmination of this new approach was achieved in Holland, perhaps the freest and most ethical society in the world at that time, in the Ethics of Baruch de Spinoza. Spinoza was to moral philosophy what his contemporary, Isaac Newton, was to natural philosophy. Spinoza was the first scientific philosopher of ethics. Other ethical philosophers such as Buddha, Confucius, Socrates, Averroes, Aquinas, and Maimonides tried to be completely rational, but Spinoza was the first to integrate ethics with mathematically based modern science. As a consequence, Spinoza, the son of Jewish refugees from Spain, was excommunicated by the Jews of Holland and persecuted by Jews, Catholics, and Protestants. It seems he had something to offend everyone. He has been condemned by religious authorities up to the present time, although the State of Israel, much to its credit, readmitted him into Judaism 300 years after his death. Maimonides was also, more briefly, excommunicated, 228. Bertrand Russell, a totally secular, anti-religious, but humane, philosopher, referred to Spinoza as the noblest and most lovable of all the great philosophers, ethically he is supreme, 358. Goethe so admired Spinoza that he claimed to read him every day as an ethical exercise. When a rabbi asked Albert Einstein if he believed in God, Einstein answered that he believed in the God of Spinoza. Einstein carefully studied the ethics of Spinoza, which have implicit in them the concepts of relativity, as well as many of the fundamental concepts of modern quantum mechanics, such as the wholeness and unity of God and the universe, 412. Science tries to be a model of objective reality, although it does not always succeed. Any true system of ethics must also be in full correspondence with objective reality. Which is to say that it must bear up well, according to its own criteria, to scientific scrutiny. There can be no contradiction between true science and true ethics. False ethics will ultimately always conflict with reality. In the modern world there have been two major experiments designed to create new, ethically based civilizations. Both of these experiments were based on a distortion of Spinoza's ethics. The most recent experiment was the Soviet Union, the first was the United States of America. American majority rule resulted from a distortion of Spinoza's ethical and political philosophy produced by the line of thinkers Locke, Hume, Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, and others leading to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson may be the most brilliant, ethical, and creative leader any nation ever had, 177-179, although like any ethical human he had many ethical flaws, 89. He, not Washington, is the ethical father of the United States, although Tom Paine might have been the midwife. Tom Paine's pamphlet Common Sense, which contained many of the ethical principles of the Declaration, was more widely read and more influential in creating the American Revolution than the Declaration itself, although the Revolution was always a minority movement, only about a third of the adult population supported it. Yet, although, 1, Jefferson clearly wanted an ethical society, based on the democratic ethic that freedom is the greatest good and tyranny is the greatest evil, and, 2, he and his two closest disciples, Madison and Monroe, were presidents for 24 consecutive years, they produced instead an increasingly unethical society that has been destroying individual freedom, almost since its inception. The democratic ethic is self-contradictory, it seeks to maximize freedom, but instead it diminishes freedom through a tyranny of the majority. It is a gross form of self-deception to believe that decisions reached by a large majority are automatically ethical and correct. We should never forget that although Hitler was originally democratically elected by a plurality, that Hitler was able to develop overwhelming majority approval and support for himself and his policies, almost to the end of his regime. The democratic ethic says that the greatest good is that which makes for the greatest liberty or welfare for the greatest number. It is right and proper for a sufficiently large majority to take away some of the liberty or welfare of a sufficiently small minority, if it will greatly increase the alleged liberty or welfare of the majority. For example, an approval by 3/4 of the state legislatures can ratify a constitutional amendment abolishing the Bill of Rights, and take away everybody's civil rights. 56. Implicit in the democratic ethic is the notion that decisions reached by large majorities are always ethically superior to decisions reached by small minorities. This is clearly false. Jefferson tried to compensate for this deficiency in democratic government by advocating and eventually getting a strong Bill of Rights to protect ethical minorities from unethical majorities and government in general. Yet, the history of the United States is the history of the ever-growing power of government and the destruction of individual liberty for the alleged benefit of the majority. This began with the toleration of slavery in the United States for 67 years, followed by government-imposed racial segregation for 50 more years. Majority rule led to the military draft, the income tax, the blatantly unconstitutional detention of Japanese Americans in concentration camps during World War II, the, allegedly, anti-communist witch hunts of the McCarthy era, the nurturing of a huge, parasitical military-industrial complex, and finally to the outright confiscation of private property with land use laws, and the gross government interference with private voluntary behavior, such as the anti-drug laws and the constant attacks on the Second Amendment by a large majority of Democrats, again for the alleged benefit of a willing, frightened majority. Therefore, the democratic ethic is a false ethic that, in trying to maximize freedom, ends up destroying freedom. A true criterion for good must not lead to its own contradiction. The most recent ethical system used to form a new civilization was the materialistic ethic of socialism, expressed in its most extreme form in the Soviet Union, which was in such conflict with true ethics and reality that it destroyed itself in only 70 years. The socialistic paradigm is that the greatest good is government control and redistribution of the wealth of the society so that there is equality of wealth independent of merit, and that the government guarantees the necessities of life to every accepted member of the society. The extreme materialistic ethic is from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, 233-235. The socialistic distortion of Spinoza's philosophy was produced by the line of philosophers Leibniz, Kant, Hegel, Marx, Engels, etc., leading to Lenin and undemocratic, completely tyrannical socialism, 388-450. All forms of tyranny are unethical. The racist National Socialism of Adolf Hitler was another unethical spin-off from Hegel. The Soviet Union, by its own criterion of good, material security, ended up impoverishing its own people by destroying their freedom and creativity, thereby contradicting its own alleged ethical purpose. This happens in all socialistic countries, it merely happens faster when they violate the criterion of the one true ethics, which was clearly articulated over 330 years ago, when Spinoza simply made explicit what was implicit in the traditional Jewish studies that he undertook as a young man. Spinoza said that the ultimate good was what he called the intellectual love of God. According to Spinoza, we love God by understanding and emulating Him. To paraphrase Spinoza, we understand God through intuition, art, science, and technology, since God is the infinite totality of all that exists. The most outstanding attribute of God is creativity. Therefore, we emulate God by maximizing creativity. This same notion of emulating God, walking in His ways, as ethical duty is in the Bible, Deuteronomy 11:22. The one true ethics is based on the notion of maximizing creativity. Good is whatever increases creativity, evil is whatever decreases creativity. I call this the evolutionary ethic. In my books I argue that any ethical system based on any other notion of good will lead to its own contradiction, as has clearly been shown for the materialistic ethic. It is currently being shown for the democratic ethic, which has turned out to be a tyranny of the majority, thereby contradicting its own fundamental ethical premises. I derived the evolutionary ethic independently of Spinoza, with the advantage of 330 years of scientific progress, by first observing that the only common denominator in the evolutionary process is ever-increasing intelligence. The biosphere becomes collectively increasingly intelligent. The protozoa are more intelligent than the bacteria, the metazoa are more intelligent than the protozoa, the vertebrates are in general more intelligent than the invertebrates, the reptiles are in general more intelligent than the fish, the mammals are in general more intelligent than the reptiles, and humans are in general more intelligent than all other mammals. Furthermore, this is the order in which the biosphere has evolved. However, intelligence is independent of ethics, up to a point, in the evolutionary process. We all know highly intelligent people who are highly unethical. The two most notorious examples in the last 100 years are Hitler and Stalin. Therefore, the maximization of intelligence is not an adequate ethical criterion. What we wish to maximize is creativity. Creativity grows out of intelligence together with ethics, but it is not identical to intelligence. Creativity will be shown to be a transcendence of intelligence. Intelligence, as I will use the concept, is the ability to predict and control the total environment, physical, biological, and psychosocial. This ability is what is growing in the biosphere. Eventually this ability grows to the point where we have intelligence of our own intelligence. That is to say, we can predict and control our own ability to predict and control. When intelligence passes this threshold, then the species begins to be ethical and as a consequence becomes creative, thereby transcending intelligence by adding a new dimension to itself. Creativity, C, is a direct interaction of intelligence, I, and ethics, E, which may be expressed intuitively in the equation C equals IE. This is the fundamental, process equation of creative transformation, 15-17. Intelligence can be used to increase intelligence, good, ethical, creative, or to diminish intelligence, evil, unethical, destructive. Therefore, intuitively, ethics are equal to our desire to increase intelligence minus our desire to diminish intelligence, the result divided by our total desire to both increase and decrease intelligence. Everything we do is done either to increase or decrease intelligence, or it is trivial, although we may not be conscious of this. Subhuman, pre-ethical, animals neither increase nor decrease intelligence, they are merely a natural part of the world which may have stopped evolving. This definition of ethics gives us dimensionless numbers between minus 1 and plus 1, 1, 1, as a measure of ethics. There is no practical way of measuring desire. However, there are practical estimators of ethics, E, one of which is the following, E equals, T, F, slash, T plus F, where T is an equivalent sampling of all the true information we believe and F is an equivalent sampling of all the false information we believe. The question that next arises is, why would anyone seek to destroy intelligence and believe false information, if he or she can otherwise create intelligence and believe true information? Before answering this question, let some terms be defined. Information is the symbolic representation of events and their relationships. Truth is information that when it is believed increases the ability of the believer to predict and control reality, i.e. the total environment, physical, biological, and psychosocial, without decreasing the believer's or anyone else's ability to predict and control the total environment. Falsehood is information that when it is believed decreases the ability of the believer to predict and control reality, i.e. any aspect of the total environment, physical, biological, and psychosocial. These notions of truth and falsehood are part of a scientific epistemology that leads to the scientific paradigm, which includes scientific method. The essence of scientific method is the experimental testing of hypotheses and theories about reality to see if they are true or false. Reality is both objective and subjective. Science deals well with objective reality, but not so well with subjective reality. Subjective reality will lead us later to consider mysticism, religion in general, and Judeo-Christian ethics in particular. We return to considering the phenomenon of evil and why some persons choose to believe falsehood. I say choose because we do not have to believe anything, we can function quite well on the basis of probabilities. A belief is a certainty about the truth or the falsehood of some proposition about nature. We choose to believe because belief makes us happy, although not necessarily more intelligent or more creative. Happiness means many different things to different people. When I use the term, I mean solely the following concept: happiness is a state of mind in which we believe that our desires are being fulfilled. Desires that have been fulfilled do not make us happy. Only desires that are being fulfilled make us happy. We all have simultaneously desires that are both being fulfilled and being unfulfilled. Unfulfilled desires make us unhappy. Therefore, we are all simultaneously happy and unhappy. If the strength and number of desires being fulfilled is greater than the strength and number of desires being unfulfilled, then the net result is happiness. The converse produces unhappiness. Intuitively, creativity is the process by which we discover scientific laws, invent machines, produce works of art, and help others do these things. The most creative thing we can ever do for ourselves is to help maximize the creativity of another. This is what in fact maximizes our own creativity. More formally, a creative act is any act which increases ethical truth for at least one person, including oneself, without decreasing ethical truth for any person, including oneself. Ethical truth is any information which increases our ethics or our creativity. The latter by increasing the ethics or intelligence of at least one ethical person, without increasing the intelligence of any unethical person. It is unethical to increase the intelligence of unethical persons, because their ethics are negative, which makes them more destructive than creative. But it is ethical to increase their ethics by communicating ethical truth to them. Everybody is benefited by the increase in anybody's ethics. Theorem 1, people are unethical if, and only if, they value happiness more than creativity. Happiness and creativity are not mutually exclusive. But neither are they the same thing. Creativity is an objective act of increasing ethical truth for oneself or for another person. Happiness is a subjective state of mind that can be induced just as easily by false as by true beliefs. Theorem 2, if we seek to maximize happiness, we minimize it and have neither happiness nor creativity in the long run, although unethical people can have a transitory minimal happiness. Theorem 3, if we seek to maximize creativity, we always succeed, and trivially also maximize happiness. Trivial refers to an entity or an act that neither increases nor decreases creativity. Trivia is a set of measure zero. Almost all acts and entities in the universe are either ethical or unethical. Theorems and ideas in this chapter are from 115,116 and 117. Corollary 3.1. There are many more ethical entities in the universe than trivial or unethical entities. Corollary 3.2. There are more angels than humans, although, at this time, there are more unethical than ethical humans, and most humans may appear trivial. Therefore, people choose to believe falsehood solely because it makes them happy, and in so doing they are behaving unethically. For that reason E equals T, F, slash, T plus F, and our ethics are directly related to the proportion of our desire for creativity over our desire for happiness. Note that creativity and happiness are not mutually exclusive, but neither are they identical. This will be elaborated later. Subhuman, pre-ethical, animals, with a very few minor exceptions, can be motivated solely by their desire for happiness, because they do not yet have intelligence about their own intelligence and do not yet have an ethical component which can produce creativity. These animals have zero creativity. That is why solely humans are systematically creative within the biosphere. That is why only humans, within the biosphere, can be systematically unethical and destructive. What makes us human is our unique ability to ethically choose creativity over happiness. Theorem 4, humans have only two primordial desires, happiness and creativity. All other desires are means for achieving the two primordial desires. By maximizing creativity with no concern for happiness, we maximize both happiness and creativity. 115, 116, 117. Therefore there exists a single ethical criterion by which all ethical decisions may be made, which is valid at all times, under all conditions for all ethical beings anywhere in the universe. It is eternally valid. This is what I call the evolutionary ethic. It is expressed as follows. We should all do our best to maximize creativity, without ever decreasing anyone's creativity, including our own. From this single, simple, but very deep, ethical imperative, we may derive a complete system of ethics to structure any society or government, to make individual decisions, to start and run a business, to educate ourselves and our children, to guide us in sexual relationships, and to relate to unethical governments, which do not follow or even pretend to follow the evolutionary ethic. The entire ethics of the Bible may be so derived. An ethical government is, therefore, the organizational structure of a society dedicated to maximizing its collective creativity without ever decreasing the creativity of any entity in the universe. Such a society has never existed. The closest approximation was Judaism under the early kings. More will be said of this later. To create an ethical government, we must preserve what has been shown to work in the past, such as Judeo-Christian ethics, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights, and eliminate all superstition that does not work, such as religious ritual and majority rule, and then restructure everything within the scientific paradigm of the evolutionary ethic. This is the purpose of this book. Such an ethical system is derived in stages, going always from more general to more specific situations. This is the same as the relationship between the Bible, Old Testament, and the teachings of Jesus. From the evolutionary ethic, the preceding considerations, and scientific reality, we derive the second stage of 8 ethical principles. 1. Any act which increases anyone's creativity, including our own, without decreasing anyone else's creativity, including our own, is ethical. This is the essence of the meaning of good. To be good is to knowingly and deliberately behave ethically, whatever the consequences. 2. Any act which decreases anyone's creativity is unethical. This is the essence of the meaning of evil. To be evil is to knowingly and deliberately behave unethically, for whatever reason. 3. Unethical means can never achieve ethical ends. 4. Means which are not ends are never ethical. 5. It is unethical to tolerate unethical or destructive behavior. 6. It is unethical to be certain about any cause and effect relationship concerning objective reality. Only probabilistic beliefs about objective reality are ethical, but we can never deny the reality of our own thoughts or perceptions, our subjective reality. We err solely when we are certain about the causes and objective reality of our subjective thoughts or perceptions. 7. It is ethical to doubt. 8. Inaction is unethical. These 8 ethical principles are derived and discussed in more detail in my previous books, 115-117. They can be used extensively to derive the same norms of behavior as in the Bible, Mishnah, and Jewish tradition in general, leading eventually to the teachings of Jesus, but not necessarily to other parts of the New Testament. The essential ethical teachings of Jesus, stripped of superstition and distortions, are best summarized in the Jefferson Bible, 176. For making any ethical decision, we must consider all 8 ethical principles, all of which are entirely scientific and secular.